Hi, friends. After a couple of false starts for telepathy and the etheric vehicle, although you do have both of those shorter programs, one of which is 40 minutes and 49 seconds, and the other one, well, just about the same, maybe a little bit longer. Anyway, you have them. And if you have any trouble seeing the video, I did not have trouble. Please let Michael Crow know, and he'll do his best. I'm beginning now with program number 3, and I call it TEVVC, Telepathy and the Etheric Vehicle Video Commentary. Here in Finland, it's the 14th to the 15th, and we're still on page 2. Let's see, maybe this is where I should be, 14:15. Okay. So it says it's the end of program number 1, but Michael did some splicing for me, and we're okay with program number 2, which was really the beginning of the text. These words, and I trust that you are seeing them. Yeah, I think you are. Okay, and we learned that there are a lot of differences between the people, their history, their environment, their nationality, whatever, as they are attracted by Master DK's invitation to work in this esoteric way, but at least they are all tuned to a similar vibration. So we've taken up this complex matter of how they achieve this common meeting ground with so many differences between them. And he says that the answer is very important. And he begins to speak of that ocean of energies we call etheric. Maybe he applies them more to our planetary scheme at first, but I think we can apply them cosmically as well. And as we ascend the ladder of evolution, it's not that higher and higher versions of this ether disappear. After all, we are living and working on the cosmic etheric physical plane. That's our locus. That's where we achieve. Now, beings like the Christ and the Buddha, they are already preparing to move onto the cosmic astral plane, which I guess, as we go on, has its own version of the ethers. So let's get into this and see what we might find that is of importance. Yeah. In approaching, therefore, The subject of telepathy, the Tibetan says, it must be carefully borne in mind that the etheric body of every form in nature is an integral part of the substantial form of God himself, not the dense physical form, but what the esotericists regard as form-making substance. So ether, may I add, I'll always say that, something like that, when it's my own thought. Ether is substantial to density. Now, our usual density is on the lowest plane of the etheric physical plane. But maybe we could consider density as any cruder type of form compared to the substantiality of the molding, M-O-U-L-D, molding substance, which is etheric. So ether is always substantial to density. That's what I want us to keep in mind. And the meaning of density does vary. Okay. Now, where am I? Here. So, DK goes on. We use the word God to signify the expression of the one life which animates every form on the outer objective plane. Well, may I suggest we have to understand what objectivity might mean. There are more objective, additional objective phases, even higher on the ladder of evolution. So, our use of the word God does not simply, I guess I meant to do this a little bit more correctly. It does not simply refer to the very lowest of the systemic planes on the cosmic etheric physical plane, which is the plane where even all of our spirituality develops. Now, mostly we confine the word God to our particular planetary logos, or maybe to the solar logos, in whom we also live and move and have our being, and we could go beyond that, finding a higher and higher instantiation of God until we reach the universal logos, which is really ourselves. But we could actually, and will, in our Identify as Being program, go even further than that. And we will find that God is a trans or supra universal deity, above really the any particular universe. But you know, keeping it fairly simple, when we pray to God, we pray to Sanat Kumara. I mean, the Christ did, and Sanat Kumara is a kind of a projection of the planetary logos. DK goes on. The etheric or energy body, therefore, of every human being. So now we're coming to humanity itself. Okay. Going on, of every human being is an integral part of the etheric body of the planet itself, and consequently of the solar system. Basically, what we have here is understanding how intimately we as human beings are related to the vast field of energies, substantial etheric energies, which are pouring through every planet in our system, and which are pouring through the solar logos of our system. And then we can go further through the cosmic logos, of which our solar logos is an integral part, and through the super cosmic logos that we sometimes call the one about whom naught may be said. Ethers are there operative, much more subtle ethers, but they are operative in a substantial way. And we could keep on going. The whole universe is our universe, and every other one that has been. Many items or things or emanations of a universe are tied together in that way by ethericity, if I can. Ethericity. That's a word that comes to me and suggests the vast extent of what we call the ether. And I'm just going to kind of note the meaning of the word. Ethericity. Yeah. Okay. Now let's see if I can. Yeah. All right. Now, we hardly know yet in our medical science, and also maybe in our particle physics pursuits, what the returning ether really is. You know that there are scientists from the end of the 19th century who dispensed with the ether altogether, simply saying it wasn't needed. And then, you know, the laws of relativity, as Einstein proposed them, began to enter, and later quantum view of our universe, but especially of the atom, began to enter, and the ether, so essential to what occultism speaks of as reality, was simply dismissed, but now it is returning. And I think that will be a big wake-up call for the occult approach to science along a number of lines. Okay, so we're talking about the etheric body of the planet and of the solar system. And DK goes on to say, through this medium, every human being is basically related to every other expression of the divine life, minute or great. Now that's quite a powerful statement, and has to do with our relations in cosmos. You know, it's a synthetic kind of statement. Through this medium of, may I add, of ether, DK goes on, every human being is basically related to every other expression of the divine life, minute or great, to atoms, to subatomic particles, to the members of the different cells and organ systems and kingdoms, both descending and ascending. Just imagine, just for a moment, imagine that you, as you think yourself to be, usually some kind of personality, maybe somewhat soul-infused, are related to every other instance, every other expression of the divine life. The DK goes on here, and minute or great. The whole universe is based upon relationship and ethericity, as I've been calling it, is one of the chief means of relating this to that, the minute to the great. The function of the etheric body, DK says, is to receive energy impulses and to be swept into activity by these impulses or streams of force emanating from one originating source or another. Now, ether may be substantial, I can say, but to a higher type of source, it is material. I mean, a particular level of ethericity is material compared to a subtler level. So DK, again, I'm going to repeat what he says. The function of the etheric body is to receive energy impulses and to be swept into activity by those impulses or streams of force emanating from some originating source or other. And here I would add, people in their etheric body, the normal etheric body, are carrying very different streams of energy. Some people are simply carrying astral energy, some lower mental energy, maybe some are carrying soul energy, or energies beyond. Energies beyond the normal personality. And maybe some are carrying monadic energy. That would be already very high. And just because we talk about it doesn't mean we really have experience with it. DK goes on. The etheric body is in reality naught but energy. It is composed, this is the classic, I'm suggesting this is the classic definition. It is composed of myriads of tiny threads of force, or let's call it energy force. Anyway, myriads of threads of force, or tiny streams of energy held in relation to the emotional and mental bodies and to the soul by their coordinating effect. So we're dealing with the factor of energy. It may be substantial, but it's not what we call dense in the way we call the objective physical plane dense. The methods of medicine, vibrational medicine, will employ the etheric body, the use of color, the use of sound. It's one of the first healing methods that will be demonstrated. All that will involve what the etheric body can carry. Now, as I said, the very difference between men, between human beings, is the kind of energy which may be impulsing their etheric body, considering the etheric body in the lowest sense as substantial or archetypal to dense objectification. These streams of energy, in their turn, have an effect upon the physical body. Now, may I say, we are now talking about the lowest plane. We're talking about the systemic plane, the systemic etheric physical plane. We're right down at the bottom. We're right down at the bottom of the chart, so to speak. I wonder if I have anything on that, or if I would have to go, whoa, have to go digging to see whether, well, I guess I would have to go digging. But maybe you know what I'm talking about. I suggest that you do know what I'm talking about. But what I'm going to do is go to the F disk and go to Tuya's diagrams, and then go to this picture. And I'm going to say that if we together look at this picture, we will find that this is the area I'm talking about, the lowest of the cosmic subplanes to be found on the cosmic etheric plane. That's this whole thing here. We're talking about how the archetypal or ether influences the dense objective level. Now, from another point of view, all, and a higher point of view, all of this Buddhic Atmic Monadic Logoic, it's considered cosmically etheric. But DK is anxious for us to understand first simply how the normal etheric body is working. Okay, now I'm hoping, yeah, so that's what it means when he says, and let me just check that I'm in the right place, because on Zoom it's so easy to go on talking about something that is not showing. What we have here is these streams of energy, the Tibetan is saying, in their turn, have an effect on the physical body and swing it into activity of some kind or another, according to the nature and power of whatever type of energy may be dominating the etheric body at a particular time, any particular time. So it's not necessarily a stable situation in relation to the etheric body. It is varying, let's say. I'm putting that in green because we're talking about the objective aspect of life. Well, and here, right here, is where the evolution of the human being can be detected. Now, DK has said that the etheric body can be controlled by thought. So, according to the quality of thought demonstrated by the individual, there will be an effect upon the etheric body, and thus an effect upon the outer type of objectivity. I'm just looking around and realizing, you know, how the etheric plane, the one I just showed you, is going to be changing and becoming more vibrant. At the same time, in process, are changes in the human eye, which will make it much more likely that the ether can be seen. And as DK says, when the time for initiation comes, people will see in the candidate the light demonstration, which proves that the individual is worthy of the first initiation. So, whether we have concrete-minded thoughts, which tend towards illusions, or whether we have thoughts which are impressed by the soul, and thus and then impress the etheric body, which then impresses the dense physical body, such a setup will be indicative of our stage of evolution. It all basically comes from the soul reflecting itself in the etheric body to the extent that it is unfolded. Now, there's a lot of people, millions, even billions, who don't have a very unfolded egoic lotus or causal body. It's appropriate to their, the degree of unfoldment is appropriate to their stage of evolution. And that's where a lot of the trouble is happening right now, because people don't know how to access the mind held steady in the light of the soul. When you look at some of those riot demonstrations, let's say you may be, you know, looking at this much later, but how the Capitol in Washington was attacked by conditioned people, not thinking people, and how they let their emotions and illusions run rampant. Well, that's the result of their stage of evolution, and to a degree, how much of the soul energy could impress the mind, then impress the etheric body, and then impress the dense outer form where behavior is found. Okay. Now, we're not exactly blazing a trail here in terms of rapidity of page changes. Anyway, we're on page 3. Through the etheric body, therefore, circulates energy emanating from some mind. Now, it can be the human mind, or it can be the mind of the angel of the presence, or of the master. It may be, if we are advanced enough, the mind of a Chohan. I'm not going to say that circulating through our etheric body will be found the same kind of mind which circulates energy through the etheric body of great beings like the Buddha and the Christ. We certainly can't say that. So, some mind or other, and the result will be either illusion, and the inability to control glamour, or there may be, if there is sufficient soul impress, the ability to transcend illusion, the illusions of the concrete mind, and the glamours of the astral body. DK goes on. With humanity in the mass, response is made unconsciously to the rulings of the universal mind. Now, maybe on the atmic plane, we begin to get a hint as to what the universal mind really is, but I think we have to travel, as it were, to the cosmic mental plane to find the universal mind. And even then, it's just as regards our local system. The universal mind is a far greater thing than can be demonstrated in our local cosmic area. So we're not, as humanity, at all sure about where these energies come from and to what extent they represent the universal mind. Because, after all, if we were sure, we would know a lot more about the divine plan functioning under the archetypal divine purpose, and that's even just for our planet. We can carry all these things further. So this unconsciousness of man in the mass, which has been so devastatingly demonstrated of late, such that hierarchy's influence on humanity is threatened by an attitude which is filled with glamour and delusion. Anyway, this response is an unconscious response, and notice the word rulings of the universal mind, because I suggest you cannot deviate from these rules. Everyone will be affected. Now, the question is whether consciously or unconsciously. Anyway, DK going on says, this is complicated in our time and age by a growing responsiveness to mass ideas, called sometimes public opinion. Now, may I suggest that's a very good definition of public opinion, which he tells us is a very powerful force that you almost will never succeed if you are working against public opinion. So this unconscious ruling, regulation, inescapable influence has a complication to it, because there's also a responsiveness to mass ideas, sometimes called public opinion, of the rapidly evolving human mentality. And I guess what that means is that human mentality can be looked at as responding increasingly to concrete-minded illusion. In the beginning, it's not so. We're just subject to glamour. The mind isn't much of a factor. But now that the human mind or mentality is evolving, we are subject to illusion, increasingly. Within, DK goes on here, within the human family are also found those who respond to that inner group of thinkers who, working in mental matter, control the subjective side of life, control from the subjective side of life, the emergence of the great plan, and the manifestation of divine purpose. Now, this is a higher, altogether higher type of response. And if we want to put it in simple terms, it means that there are people who are responding to the hierarchy, to the masters, to the Chohans, and to even Sanat Kumara, as the Christ did in the Garden of Gethsemane. We really have no idea about what he appreciated there in those agonizing moments. But we do have the sense that if he had not acquiesced to the divine will as presented to him in that garden, things would be a lot worse for humanity now. So he was the world's savior, and he was privileged to be the first to respond fully to the divine will and really anchor it for many human beings. So sometimes we just have to look at the difference. Humanity en masse and those higher types of responders, such as the Christ, the Buddha, and maybe great lords that have passed beyond our ken, the lords of liberation, the spirit of peace, the avatar of synthesis. Maybe they do not exactly come from our planet, but they are associated with our planet at this time. So, okay. Now, let's see how he classifies these thinkers. This will be interesting. This higher group of thinkers, I guess, inner group of thinkers, looks like that's what he's going to be dealing with here. This group of thinkers, he says, falls into seven main divisions and is presided over by three great lives or super conscious entities. Now, we know who they are. We know very little of what they do, but notice He's calling them superconscious entities, which, excuse me, they would have to be to receive the impression of divine purpose from those who are even higher, such as particularly Sanat Kumara or the planetary logos. These three are the Manu, the Christ, and the Maha Chohan. All right, we're familiar with that idea. So I'm going to kind of put this into something more outstanding. These three are the Manu, the Christ, and the Maha Chohan, so says Master DK. These three work primarily through the method of influencing the minds of the adepts, those are masters, and the initiates, who are initiates of a lower degree than master. These latter, in their turn, influence the disciples of the world, and these disciples, each on in his own place and on his own responsibility, work out the concept of the plan and seek to give it expression as far as possible. Now, what we basically have here, we have at least three, four, five, six, and we will have aspirants as well. So here are three, and here are adepts, here are initiates, here are disciples, and let's just say the aspirants are influenced by the disciples. I guess there are seven. Pretty clear. Maybe seven groups of lives. That's what he was talking about. Okay. It is, therefore, this is the Tibetan going on, it is therefore, as you can surmise, a process of stepping down of vibration until they are sufficiently heavy. May I add, I guess by that it means slower, more congealed, less vibrant. So DK is saying, until they are sufficiently heavy to affect physical plane matter and thus make possible the building of organized effects upon the physical plane. Okay, again, because the physical plane is involved, I will put that into the green. If I had to look at colors, you know, the physical plane would be generically the green, and the etheric body generically the violet. And so what we're trying to do is get the violet into the green. Well, where are we in this chain? We are somewhere, probably associated as we are with Master Decay. It's not with the Manu, the Christ, and the Mahachohan, although a relationship with any of them may be possible, if they are the guiding master. There are those, you know, the Mahachohan is one of the externalizing masters, or Chohan. The Christ, of course, such a big discussion exists about his externalization. I don't think the Manu is one of the externalizing masters, but he does have Master Moria, Master Jupiter, as representing his will. Okay. These disciples have hitherto worked very much alone, DK says, except when karmic relationships have revealed them to each other and telepathic intercommunication has been fundamentally confined to the hierarchy of adepts, the and initiates, both in and out of incarnation, and to their individual work with their disciples, mostly the souls or angel of the presence of their disciples. DK seems to be gearing up here to tell us that things are changing. So he's stopping. He's not mentioning much about the aspirants. He's stopping with the sixth descent, that of the disciples. But who else would they work with except those who are aspiring, you know? Okay. But now what? It is, however, now deemed possible to establish a resembling condition and a telepathic relation between disciples on the physical plane. That is a very important new development. Obviously, what hierarchy can do, it is hoped that disciples can one day do. Now, the now of this has a lot to do with work that was going on in the 1930s. But it still certainly does apply to us today. Now, DK goes on, no matter where they may find themselves, this, see, so geography, may I add, doesn't make all that much difference, right? It makes some difference, it's conditioning, but there's some adherence to a common vibration which overcomes the usual distinctions between people. And they learn to see each other that way, no matter where they may find themselves. This group of mystics and knowers will eventually find it feasible, possible, to communicate with one another, and frequently do even now. So DK sees something that probably many of us do not see. There is a kind of already generated telepathic rapport going on with this. Notice he calls them this group of mystics and knowers. I guess as a disciple, you can be either one. The mystics tend to become lords of compassion, and the knowers tend to become what's called masters of the wisdom. Okay, DK goes on. A basic idea, a basic mystical idea, or some new revelation of truth is suddenly recognized by many and finds expression simultaneously through the medium of many minds. So, what is happening when that is the case? Because, you know, it's the old 100th monkey idea that there comes that moment of group realization. And it doesn't just have to be one at a time. DK goes on, no one person can claim individual right to the enunciated principle of truth. Several minds have registered it. It is usually stated, however, in a wide generalization that these people have tapped the inner thought current or have responded to the play of the universal mind. Literally and technically, this is not so. So he's going to make a distinction here, but suffice it to say, there comes a time of sudden coalescence, sudden recognition of thought or idea or some principle of truth. Now, I think what he's saying here is that this is a telepathic response between those who register fairly simultaneously this new truth. Now, what about that universal mind? He says it's not a response to the universal mind. The universal mind is tapped by some member of the planetary hierarchy. Or what, you know, what can we call that universal mind? The atmic plane? And what goes on the atmic plane? Maybe it's the third plane, but the Buddha found himself able to contact cosmic mind on the cosmic mental plane. So that was a very unusual touch. Suffice it to say, universal mind, or this tapping of the atmic plane on which it is said that all knowledge is found. Well, what is all knowledge, at least with respect to our planet and maybe local cosmos, but I would confine it to our planet at this time. The universal mind is tapped by some member of the planetary hierarchy, according to his mental bias and equipment, and the immediate needs sensed by the working adepts. So some very high contacts, higher than they are tapped. Now, what is the descent of this tapping? What happens? That we have to see according to what TK says. He goes on to say, he then presents the new idea, a new discovery, or the new revelation to the group of adepts, telepathically, of course, my brother. He doesn't get together for a lecture and say, guess what I found. So we're talking about now, I think, some very high members of the hierarchy who are Chohans and of the sixth degree and maybe seventh degree, and or becoming seventh degree, and they present the new revelation through telepathy to the adepts who are masters but cannot reach that high. And then note this, and when it has been discussed by them, he later presents it to his group of disciples. Now, maybe we're talking about a very high type of Chohan who has what? A group of disciples? It would seem to me that the masters who engaged in this discussion would be in a very good position to present the result of their discussion to their disciples, if I have it correctly. So, the working adepts, apparently, are not quite as high as some even higher sources who receive, as Chohans, the impression, and then who present their impressions to lesser Chohans and to adepts who cannot yet, without their help, receive such impressions. Okay, disciples. Among them, he will find one who responds more readily and intelligently than the others, and this one, through his clear thinking and the power of formulated thought forms, can then influence other minds. And I would suggest that what this one can influence are the minds of aspirants who really are far down the chain of lighted descent. These others, says the Tibetan, grasp the concept as theirs. They seize upon it and work it out into manifestation. Well, they say, my idea, my thought, and so forth. They're not yet sophisticated enough to know what is the impulsive chain of light which has influenced them. Each regards it, says the Tibetan, as his special privilege so to do, and because of the specializing faculty and his automatically engendered responsibility, he throws back of it all the energy which is his. And now he's talking about aspirants, I guess, and the works and works and fights for his thought forms. This is the common response for many people receiving this kind of impression, and they're not occultists, they're not esotericists, they don't really know where it came from, they don't have the kind of awe, I guess, of the descent from sources by which they were reached. They may simply, you know the disciple, or maybe not, who imparted to them this idea as impressed upon the disciple by the master, or if it's a very high disciple, by a Chohan, and so forth. So there are many people working externally, objectively in the world, who get an idea, a thought, not knowing where it comes from, but they feel so charged by it that they really try to work it out. And maybe the majority is this way. After all, there are many disciples as well who are not aware of their relationship to the hierarchy, but by their works they can be known. Okay. So interesting. Very interesting. Well, maybe we can take it as far as the second law of telepathy. So DK is talking about the descent of light, the descent of lighted impression. And he says, an illustration of this is to be found in the history of the League of Nations. Now, this followed, upon the First World War. It was humanity's pre-United Nations attempt to put something together that would really preserve the peace. And it, you know, eventually, as we know, it did not work out. But here is our story about the descent of light. The descent of lighted impression. Before he took up special work, that's what DK is saying, and I just want to add that that special work is with the Deva Kingdom, readying them for interplay with humanity and for a great renaissance, which is coming, okay. Then DK goes on, the Master Serapis sought to bring through some constructive idea for the helping of humanity. He conceived of a world unity, that, may I add, as naturally he would, being a fourth ray master, and the highest aspect of that ray is unity and harmony. Okay, he conceived of a world unity in the realm of politics, which would work out as an intelligent handling or banding of the nations for the preservation of international peace. Now note here, how very much like the later and far more successful United Nations the conception of Master Serapis was. But he's a master, okay. Whether he is also a Chohan, I think it can be said, yes, at least now, just the way the Master Jesus is a Chohan. I'm sorry. He presented it to the adepts in conclave. Was it 1925? And it was felt that something could be done. The Master Jesus undertook, now here's cooperation, to present it to his group of disciples as he was working in the Occident, where, you know, that war had precipitated. Okay. Now, this is interesting because it shows the cooperation of two lords of compassion. Master Serapis, probably a Chohan, and Master Jesus, definitely at that time, a Chohan. He presented it to his group of, may I say, idealistic disciples, because it was a great ideal, and these six-ray types could relate to it. And he was working in the Occident, where all the trouble of the First World War, or the majority of that trouble, had occurred. One of these disciples on the inner planes seized upon the suggestion. Now, this is a high disciple, and passed it, or rather stepped it down until it registered in the brain of Colonel House. So there is an inner disciple of relatively high rank who is connected with what? He's connected with Colonel House. And so he, and not recording the source, of which he was totally unaware, so maybe he's delegating here. DK is telling us that Colonel House was a kind of outer disciple. He, Colonel House, not understanding where the impression had come from, passed it on, in turn, to that sixth-ray aspirant called Woodrow Wilson. He was president of the United States at that time. So, you know, so far, we see quite a line of descent. And if Colonel House was not aware of where this impression came from, then Woodrow Wilson is likely to think that Colonel House is the source, because it was passed on, and DK specifies, to an aspirant called Woodrow Wilson. Then, the Tibetan says, fed by the wealth of analogous ideas in the minds of many, it was presented to the world. So we understand now, don't we? How all the way from Master Serapis, through Master Jesus, through an inner disciple, through Colonel House, an outer disciple, apparently, and through and to the aspirant Woodrow Wilson, the idea descended. The idea of the League of Nations, sort of handed over to the sixth ray ashram, considering that it had been conceived by the director of the fourth ray ashram. Okay, it should be, DK goes on, it should be borne in mind that the function of a disciple is to focus the stream of energy of some special kind upon the physical plane, where it can become an attractive center of force, draw to itself similar types of ideas and thought currents, which are not strong enough to live by themselves or to make sufficiently strong impact upon human consciousness. That's quite a valuable sentence, I think. The function of a disciple. Function of a disciple, says Master DK. Let's see if, as disciples, we are somewhat adhering to this, is to focus a stream of energy of some special kind upon the physical plane, where it can become an attractive center of force and draw to itself similar types of ideas and thought currents, which are strong enough to live by themselves or to make sufficiently strong impact upon human consciousness. I mean, didn't Alice Bailey do this with her starting of the Arcane School and her work for the Tibetan physical plane centers were produced, and people were magnetized by them. But on their own, these magnetized people maybe could not have done very much, but together they could. So here is the statement: in union is strength. And this is the second law governing telepathic communication. Well, that's going to have to be enough for tonight so far. Cross my fingers here. There's been no collapse of the system. And I think I could go, we have reached all of page 5. Oh, goodness. We are charging along. And basically, I'm going to transfer this down to the place where we are stopping. That story of Serapis, Jesus, the disciple, Colonel House, the aspirant Woodrow Wilson, that's a very practical example, isn't it? It somehow demonstrates this descent of higher power. So this is the end of program three. Starting from page two and going to page five. And the next discussion between us is the beginning of program four of Telepathy and the Etheric Vehicle video commentary, and it will be on XX of October 21 from page 5 and onward. And I think I'll send this now. It's not the only way I like to send these things. As you know, I have kind of a special list of people who want to receive the audio transcript directly, but this will be at least a way of sending it, and BL will put it up on Makara, and Harold and Joe will put it up on YouTube, and you should be able to access it if you want to review it. And people who have not been able to attend here can also review what they missed, because much as I would like to, except under extraordinary circumstances, I just can't do the morning programs, you know, which would amount to, well, I won't get into it. So, lots of love to everybody from Tuya and myself and the communications team, and it's my hope that yeah, that's correct. I've been showing you the correct screen. That's good. And now I'll just stop the recording, and then we'll see what we can send you. With love and many blessings.